So we're going to move to our first panel discussion for today. This one's focused on how the availability of capital impacts the role of the CMO. And I'm very happy to introduce my friend Lou Brenner, who's going to run this session, and his team. Well, why don't you guys come up and they'll introduce themselves. Lou and I had the opportunity of working together at AMAG Pharmaceuticals and had a great time there.
While everyone settles in, let me sort of talk for a moment just about how this panel came together. I was called by the organizers and asked about a topic that I thought would be interesting, and I guess be careful what you wish for, because this is the one that I had suggested. I think one of the things that's been a consistent factor for me, as I think across the places where I've been, and I think it probably consistent, is that one of the key jobs of the CMO is resource management. Those resources come in a variety of forms, always financial, but human as well, and that we're in a particular time in the industry now where the flux of capital into the industry is dramatically different than most of us can remember in our careers. And so we thought that this topic in particular, you know, how to manage resources, the availability of capital, broadly defined, but certainly financial capital, human capital, and intellectual capital would be a really interesting topic. And so with that, I'm very glad we had the chance to talk last week and prepare for this, but maybe my colleagues could introduce themselves briefly.
Good morning. Oliver Rosen, Chief Medical Officer, Deciphera Pharmaceuticals in Waltham right now.
And maybe we could also say whether they're private or public companies, because I actually think that that actually is one of the themes that we'll draw out today.
Private, on the verge of going into a mezzanine-funded situation.
Jim Roach, Chief Medical Officer at Momenta Pharmaceuticals, which is a public company since 2004, I believe.
Raj Malik, CMO at G1 Therapeutics. We're a venture-backed company, just raised a Series B a couple of months ago.
Hi, my name is Ian Walters. I'm Chief Medical Officer at Intensity Therapeutics, which is a small private biotech company in the cancer immunotherapy space. I also do double duty. I am also a venture partner for a fund that invests in private companies.
Okay, great. Thanks, everyone. And so just to preface, anyone has questions along the way, we'd be happy to take them. We have a few topics that we'd plan to cover, but we'd be glad to take the conversation in whatever direction the folks here would like to do that. The first question that we had posed is, how does the CMO retain both scientific and clinical rigor in the setting of both resource-constrained and also well-funded environments? And I think that one of the jobs of the CMO is to maintain the scientific and patient-focused compass, you know, much like Ken Getz's discussion before, to keep a focus on the patient, but the CMO's job in that context of both being resource-rich or resource-poor, and I'll throw it out to the panel.
Sorry. I'll break the ice. So I think the challenge is really that this dual role that a CMO has. On one hand, the CMO has to be the visionary of the company where to take things, but on the other hand, the CMO also has to be the referee. And I think that's particularly challenging when you have a change, for example, in your funding situation. You go from groups with different interests. I mean, you transition through stakeholders with different interests. And so I think keeping this momentum is something which is a little of a challenge at times when new investors come in, for example, with a different interest.
Yeah, I think it's also, I mean, it's at the end of the day, our job is to figure out if the drug works, how can you generate value to maximize the return on whatever stage the investors are, whether they're private, whether they're public shareholders. And of course, those value inflection points can come at different points, either within a trial or after a trial, depending on how the trial is designed. So, you know, I think those are the challenges. So from the way as I think about it, you know, trying to make trials as efficient as possible, from an adaptive Bayesian type design to try and, you know, shorten and get your data inflections in as much rigorous and short a period of time. I think that is certainly key no matter which funding environment you're on, I think.
Jim, I think of your role as really interesting in this, where you've had both a really novel biosimilar platform, but also a new drug development platform. And maybe you could talk a little bit about how you've sort of balanced those, the tension between the novel drug development, which is obviously harder, versus the biosimilar platform, which would create a different form of value for patients and for the company as well.
Sure. Let me come back to that in the context of my answer to the first question, because I think for many of us who have been doing this a long time, we've probably been in situations where things have been flush and things have been not so flush. And I just look at my own experience. I'll just go back as far as 99. I was at Leukocyte. Millennium acquired us. This was the time around the sequencing of the human genome. Everything was going crazy. And as I recall, the stock was like 86, and that was after two splits, and we went down to 16 pretty quickly, right? At Sepracor, we were 55 or so. We got a non-approval letter for what was supposed to be the next big drug and went down to $3.90 a share, clawed our way back up. Momenta's certainly been up and down. And I guess what I've learned from that collective experience is to never get too high or too low on where the financing is. Things seem to go in cycles, but if you're focused on the best way to develop a product, you might tweak plans around the edges based on the availability of funding, but I think there's still one best way to develop whatever asset you're working on, and you shouldn't put too much into it extra in an inefficient way if you have too much money. And conversely, when the funding is really tight, I think it's our job to advocate for the best way to develop the compound. We're often pressured to take shortcuts around protocols or only do a proof of mechanism study but don't think about anything else. You don't have money to do anything else, instead of thinking about trying to build that long-term value for what a partner might be looking for. So I think we really need to stay focused in either circumstance and advocate to our boards, our internal management, what the best way is to try and develop it and fight that battle. And getting to your comment about biosimilars and novel drugs, first I would say I'm not so sure that it's easier to develop biosimilars than novel drugs, right? It's very different, but I'll be speaking about that later this afternoon. I think even with whether it's biosimilars, whereas like a generic, the POS is much higher, right? If you can reverse engineer a compound, obviously getting it approved is much higher, but there may be less on the back end of it versus novel drugs where the POS, generally speaking, you saw the numbers from Ken, right? 10% IND. But still, I think you have to be focused on what the best development strategy is.
Just one thing that I'd like to add to this is it's also often a challenge. It requires a lot of perseverance if a target falls off grace. Yeah, I mean, there's fashion times, fashion cycles, and so sometimes we can perfectly explain why a study failed, and then to keep investors engaged is sometimes a little bit challenging.
So, Ian, I wanted to ask you in follow-up to Jim's comment, because this is part of our prep call last week, is that you talked about the tension between doing it right versus doing it fast, particularly in a small company that's resource constrained. And maybe you want to talk about that, because I think that's a common sentiment that we heard in the prep call as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on who your investor base is and what the expectations of the company and how much cash you have on the balance sheet. I've seen, personally, I've had to deal with a lot of challenge on how much time do I spend on fundraising, how much time do I spend on what I would say creative fundraising, which is partnering and finding non-dilutive ways of financing programs through partnerships and academic collaborations versus actually doing the day-to-day work. And that, we've been fortunate as a very small private company. We have a lot of control on what's going on. We don't have a lot of investors and venture capitalists telling us, oh, you need to do it this way, or you need to do it this way, or elsewhere. And I can tell you, my company Intensity has gone from a concept in someone's mind to an IND and $2 million, which is almost unheard of in the financial space of being able to take a technology, develop it, and get it to an IND that quickly, because it's just a few people working very hard and not having a lot of people telling us, well, you need to spend money on this, and you need to spend money on this, and why aren't you doing this? That being said, we still spend a lot of time thinking about financing and how we're going to finance the rest of the programs and how we get to proof of concept and whether you do that quick or not. And for a small private company, getting clinical proof of concept and getting clinical data obviously is paramount. And we have a platform, and I debate with my CEO all the time, how much money are we going to use to develop the platform or to bring new compounds versus take our lead program and just get clinical proof of concept. And I think that's an important decision you have to make, you know, as a CMO, and on how much time you spend on those both areas to try to optimize value. You know, you want to optimize value for the platform because you think you have something that can impact disease. At the same point, you know, cash is not unlimited, and you really need to kind of optimize the value to shareholders so that you can grow the business.
This brings up a point that we also talked about, is the short-term versus long-term tension, and the building of enough infrastructure to achieve your goals, but not so much that the finances of the company can't bear it. And so, Raj, you talked about this in the call. How do we think about building the company, which is usually a commitment to people and infrastructure, versus building the asset, which can be done in a more virtual model, and some of the tension associated with that? Because I think that, again, that's affected by the availability of capital as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also the stage of company, because I think, and it's also what the, you know, the overall strategy of the company is from a board and investor perspective, particularly if you're a private company, in terms of exits and so on. But, you know, as a CMO, the way I think about it is, no matter what, the job needs to get done. And so, you know, if in the short term, if that means bringing in, you know, consultants, and one thing that I think this industry, from this perspective, is mature. There are a lot of really good, talented people out there who just want to consult. And if there are ways of engaging them and helping your program move forward without actually building out an infrastructure during that period of time when you're not really sure what the future direction of the company is, that's the way I would proceed. I think if it's clear that one is going to go and, you know, try and access the public markets and really become more of a larger company, then for sure it makes more sense to, you know, build that infrastructure internally. I mean, so, but my overriding principle is always, you know, not having resources cannot be a reason why a project doesn't move forward, because that's a tough one to sell to a CEO and certainly to the board. So,
Oliver, how do you think about that? If you describe it as a mezzanine round, that's the, I think, right around the time when a company goes through that kind of spiritual decision, is how much to invest in people in the company and how much to build versus doing it on the outside.
I mean, I can say from my experience when I joined the company, it was a virtual company, and it took me a lot of time to turn it into a functional unit, so to say, because, and I probably don't make a lot of friends with the sponsors of the meeting here, but I had a lot of bad experiences with consultants and contractors. I mean, when you have very specific questions, then they're perfect. But taking something really over the finish line, that's something where you never get any relief as a CMO. And so when you see that the burning rate is constant and you don't deliver on milestones, that is a big challenge. And so I would always vote in favor of really building up a company first, and then, or at least in parallel, and not say initially virtual and then afterwards physical company, so to say. Yeah.
Jim, how do you think about that? Because you've seen a variety of environments where that has happened.
Sure. Well, I think it's a balance. But I think for most companies, and certainly perhaps most companies represented here, will be running trials with a lot of external resources, right? But I've certainly advocated for bringing in senior people who can oversee the resources and oversee the vendors and have that subject matter expertise. I was just talking to somebody earlier this morning. We were chatting, and I've always believed that if you can get your hands on a good biostatistician and a good medical writer, never let them go. And one of my first hires, in addition to an operations person, was an in-house medical writer that can also do a number of other things. But when you're managing the CRO vendors, instead of, you know, getting an associate director operations person that has done some monitoring, I would advocate bringing somebody in at like a VP level who's had a tremendous amount of experience that can manage these resources. And across the board for each functional area, that's certainly how I've viewed it in terms of building up my own group.
I mean, I have to agree, and I think it somewhat depends on the skill sets that you have in leadership roles. So some leaders are kind of generalist drug developers and have a broad background that covers a lot of different spaces, and some are specialists, right? And if you have generalist leaders within your organization, who have a good knowledge base of different components of drug development, you know, it makes outsourcing a lot easier because you know what questions to ask, you know exactly what you need, and you know how to kind of hold people accountable to delivering on those tasks. So we've been very, my company's been pretty effective as two people overseeing a whole slew of consultants and getting things done, you know, super fast without building up a lot of infrastructure. But we tend to be, both of us, very generalist, have worked in just about every department of a major pharma company overseeing those groups, so we have the ability to outsource effectively. That being said, my fund also that I work with has a network of 30 to 40 very senior people that we can tap on, that we know, that we've worked with, that have head departments. So the choice of consultants becomes very simple. We have our network. We go to them all the time. We have established relationships. We know what they can deliver. So it enables us to kind of leverage a few people to kind of have a big reach.
I think the other important aspect is really to take that very serious vendor selection. I mean, initially it seems like we're just looking for a couple of vendors or so, but really taking time and bringing in a couple of companies has been for us very successful because obviously we have to rely on external partners. And so that's something I would also always recommend that people really take the time, although it's tedious.
And just one other comment from my perspective. We know what resources we need and the kinds of people we need better than anybody else in the company, right, for the development programs. That's not to say we'll always get what we want, and certainly I haven't. But I think it's really important to really strongly advocate for why it is that you might need this and this and this senior person when people are pushing for less or junior resources or externalizing everything. Because I certainly, you know, thinking back at my 7-plus years now at Momenta with the people that we've brought in, it's really paid off its weight in gold in terms of the money, as an example, that the senior people have been able to negotiate through our vendors and save, you know, just save all kinds of money that junior people wouldn't be able to do.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. What I was saying before, I think it's not, there has to be a hybrid approach. I mean, you have to have enough internal expertise to really be able to work with the, because we all work in outsourced environments. So you have to have a core internal expertise to really drive the strategy, no matter what, you know, what aspect of that is.
Yeah. Jim used a word that I think is really important here, is advocacy, the CMO's job, almost independent of the circumstances, advocacy, but it varies. And I thought one of the things that we talked about as we prepared for this is advocating for a significant program within a portfolio in a bigger company versus advocating for what sometimes in a small company is a single project. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about that tension in an environment when the capital is constrained, because this is something that Ian really kind of highlighted, that even though the industry is flush in some places, small companies are still kind of struggling to raise capital now. And so maybe we could talk a little bit about advocacy based on the environment as well. Go ahead, Ian.
You know, obviously, if you follow all the financial metrics, there's a lot of money flowing into the space. And at least all the metrics I've seen say that there's a shortage of companies. It doesn't feel that way to me as I'm on the roadshow today, tomorrow, and wherever else. You know, we happen to be lucky. We're in the cancer immunotherapy space, which is hot. You know, I spent my last 7 years at Bristol Myers developing cancer immunotherapy. You know, I know everybody in the industry, and you know, you would think it's easier to kind of say, hey, we have the next greatest thing in cancer immunotherapy, and people would be throwing money at you. But, you know, I think there's a small group of venture funds that are focusing on early kind of seed round, Series A, early technologies, and they tend to focus primarily on things coming out of academia with big name scientists and things of that nature. And if you don't fall in that mode, it's a little bit more challenging to kind of convince these people to take a risk and to bet on you. And, you know, as much as you can advocate to say, hey, we have the next kind of big thing in this hot area, it's, well, where's your human data? You know, you're a preclinical company, and, you know, we don't know how the preclinical data translates in the field of cancer, at least, into human experience. So, you know, I, like I said, I'm conflicted about, and I think my
kind of strategy to deal with that is I have to get to humans as fast as I possibly can, just to kind of put all these people at ease that, you know, the clinical data is going to reproduce what we've shown preclinically. At the same time, I'm trying to figure out what the platform is and how to kind of best leverage that. And it's, believe me, I stay up at night thinking about this every day. How much do I do? And am I, you know, spending more time on the platform, or am I doing this? And how do I advocate in a way that I can convince people that it makes sense to do both in parallel? And that's kind of my job day to day.
So that raises, I think, and one of the things that was part of our discussion last week is, I think it's one of the elephants in the industry is, it used to be that the threshold for progress, for real currency in this business, was human data. Yet we're seeing in the past several weeks even, companies with public market caps in excess of $1 billion who have not even entered the clinic, let alone filed an IND. And so I thought it would be good, and maybe we can engage some audience participation as we think about some of the buzzwords that are out there now. Immuno-oncology, CAR-T, gene therapy, where we as, you know, physicians who are stewards of capital, how we think about really a change in the way that the industry is being at least valued now, and whether that's appropriate or not, because I think that that's, and as we talked on Friday, one of the really important things here.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yeah, so this is another area where I think if you've been doing this for 20 years or more, you see the pendulum go like this between platform and late phase assets, right? And around the 99-2000 and there, that time frame, everything was platform. I think it's only recently that it's opened up to platform again. Most people still seem very interested in late stage assets, both in terms of deals and in terms of company valuation. And again, I think the right answer is in the middle. Really interesting and novel platform technologies, if they're validated through a reason to believe in preclinical science and biology, should be worth something. But, you know, again, we've seen the irrational exuberance, and it does swing both ways. I happen to be working on an oncology drug now that we really believe in, but it's not immuno-oncology, and it's not a targeted therapy. And that's been a real challenge for us to try to speak with people who believe that the only way you might have a path forward in oncology is to be pursuing one of these areas. And again, you just try and do the best you can to advocate.
Maybe I'll ask for a show of hands. How many folks in the audience either work in a company that's in immuno-oncology or have had active discussions within their company to be part of the immuno-oncology wave?
But Lou, I think these valuations and these examples that you cite are all driven by a few sets of funds that are doing this kind of work. They put, you know, great boards in front of these. They build incredible scientist teams. They have a great track record with bringing in, attracting high-profile funds. And if you're not part of that group, I think it's a whole different story. So then these investors have tons of leverage. And from the entrepreneur side, personally, I don't want to give up that leverage, you know, because I feel confident in what my company's been able to build. So it makes it pretty difficult to kind of deal with that environment, because they have such a strong kind of hold on what's going on. I mean, I talked to some of these funds, and they're like, their first initial comment, well, are you interested in spinning your technology into one of our companies? Well, absolutely not. You know, there's no reason to do that. We have our own technology, and we have enough capital. Why would I want to do that? But, you know, it's really an interesting environment, I think. And like I said, you know, even though you're in the hot area, we just got back from the American Association of Cancer Research meeting, and I think everybody now believes that their drug has some effect on the immune system.
Yes, absolutely. Put that IO label on. I know we're trying hard to figure that one out.
But I think it's very important with such a hot field like immuno-oncology, and regardless whether what it is, I think what we need is more diversity, because there's a kind of a herd mentality. I mean, you hear now CAR-T, and then everybody who uses the word CAR-T attracts a lot of interest. And when you have a different approach that people don't yet know, you're left alone. And so I was always a believer that if it takes you 10 minutes to tell your story, you don't have a story. But you need basically 5 seconds to tell your story. And that's, in a day and age where science has made so much progress, it's really hard to tell any story in that short amount of time if it's new. Yeah.
One of the other topics is that we talked about is the difference of the role of the CMO in the phase of the company. You know, if we use just the drug development phase. One of the things that I've observed and we talked about last week was that there are more CMOs in preclinical companies than you would have expected. And preclinical companies are hiring CMOs to actually guide the company. And so, you know, Ian, maybe you're an example of this, but others in the room who wanted to chime in, you know, how does the traditionally the CMO is thought of, you come in phase two or even into phase three, but this role is being touted a lot earlier in the life cycle of a company.
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge you have, and I'm thinking at it from the investor side, is can you justify a CMO salary and equity position when you're preclinical, right? And if, most people will say, no, you can't. I mean, it's just too costly and it doesn't make sense. But you want to have, you know, proper insight and into the development plans and the disease areas and how to leverage your technology early on. And how do you get that? So, you know, there's a lot of people where, well, maybe you need a part-time CMO or you need a consultant CMO who can come in at an early stage and give you some guidance. Are you going in the right direction? Are you designing the right experiments? If you build it, will people want it in the clinic and so on and so forth? So, I've seen a lot of creative solutions on how to address that. But I agree with you. Having a full-time experienced chief medical officer in a preclinical company doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless that CMO is somebody who likes to do financing or likes to do some of the translational work or can, you know, kind of branch out beyond the traditional role, I think, of the CMO. That's been my experience.
Yeah, I would agree with that, too. And I've been, even prior to landing my current gig, I actually played that part-time CMO role, helping a few folks while they're trying to figure out, is this a real company? And can, you know, is this financeable? So I think that's where, you know, someone, you know, people here and all of you in the room with the experience can really bring a lot of value. Because the other aspect is also, particularly in those early stage companies you mentioned, you know, there are certain venture groups that are putting a lot of money into, you know, the people who've been very successful bringing companies out of academia, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. There is a much larger group of people who are doing equally good as science, whose compounds and ideas could have real value, but they really don't have the expertise to figure out what's the difference between research and development. And that makes a huge difference in terms of being able to then go to, you know, some of the venture firms you mentioned to say, hey, you know, put in some seed capital here. There's really something here, and take a bet. Unfortunately, those groups are far and few. You know, there aren't as many. But I think that's where, if you're talking about it purely from a preclinical perspective, where a CMO, you know, not necessarily an employee of mm-hmm. the company, but CMO role, mm-hmm. I think can bring a lot of value.
I think, I mean, I'm speaking clearly out of terms here in regards to my experience, but what I can see as a value is bringing a CMO early on is to start translational activities early on, because I've seen companies struggling with curing lots of mice and lots of different cancers, but then the target is not right, or you don't understand really how to measure the target, how to quantify the target, and these are things that I think in today's area of personalized medicine cannot be undervalued enough. Yeah,
and I would echo that. I think when I joined Momenta, we were largely a preclinical company. We had one phase two study that was just beginning in cardiovascular and nothing else that was close to the clinic. And they were very open with me at the time that there was a big debate internally about is now the time to bring in a CMO. But as I reflect back, you know, I think that one thing we can do for these kinds of companies is to provide a rigorous development and commercial perspective on everything that's going on in preclinical research. And I'm sure we've all seen the companies that are heavily research-oriented and kind of shift towards that transition to development. And it's often a very rocky transition, right? But I think we can, again, provide this perspective and do a lot of different things, right? If you are interested in financing or regulatory policy, there's a lot of different roles, I think, that we can serve in preclinical companies that I think is of value.
This wasn't on script, but I think it's actually a really rich topic. Just show of hands, how many folks in the room have worked for multiple companies or consulted for companies that didn't have a CMO or were thinking about hiring a CMO? Is that? So I think
it's a tough personal choice too, because you know you go to a preclinical company as a CMO, you're putting a lot of eggs in one basket, and typically, you know, we know the success rates of these type of things. Obviously, you don't need to get to the market to have some sort of upside from that. And, you know, for me personally, I want to hedge my bet a little bit because, you know, I know that not all these projects are going to succeed. And you know, from the investor side, too, you know, if you're able to kind of attract somebody who's a high-profile CMO, has good drug development experience, that is a big help to de-risk programs and so on. So, because you know a good CMO will be able to correct course or change course or do something to try to make sure that things don't dwindle and die away.
Is that one question? We're a model simulation company, statistics company. We do a lot of model simulation, especially in the area of portfolio design. So from a drug portfolio, so you're looking at a timeline, but how to design your trials, so you're just set R&D, how to design your trial to optimize so that you're getting maybe ultimately get the right MPV. We do it theoretically with a lot of people, but and we go and we talk to a lot of companies and everyone agrees that it should be done that way. But the groups never talk to each other. So the finances, you know, we don't control that clinical budget for the design side. The clinical guys say, well, we don't have the true numbers in finance to get the finance. So is it the CMO's job to have that oversight and have that long-term outlook? Or I mean, I just find it odd that never get them to agree and say, everyone likes what they see, but no one ever, yeah.
So for those who didn't hear, is the role of the CMO bridging the gap between finance, clinical?
Yeah, finance and, you know.
Portfolio optimization.
Portfolio optimization,
yep.
Really, yep.
The answer is yes.
It should be. I mean, it depends. I mean, I see a lot of people, you know, small companies recruit academics to be their chief medical officer who have, you know, domain expertise in that disease area. But those people typically haven't had to do a before portfolio optimization, NPV calculation, or anything of that nature to kind of really understand how best to kind of support those type of decisions. I really think you have to be, you know, in industry a long time and have to deal with this, you know, on the small company side and even on a big company side when you have 250 research projects you're trying to optimize, to have the insight to be able to look at numbers and say, well, the marketing guy just jigged that so the MPV was positive or something of that nature. We really need to understand the MPV is not the answer. It's an input to a decision.
So I think that maybe that's one of the last topics we can cover, and Jim touched on it a bit as well. Macroeconomic policy has allowed a lot of capital and some successes in the industry have allowed a lot of money to flow into biotech that traditionally hasn't flown into biotech. And so how do we think about there are environments maybe not fully represented by people in the room, but the industry in general has more money to do drug development than it's had at least in most of our careers. And so how do we as CMOs or you know clinical executives think about the availability of that money because it could dry up at some point, you know? And what's the, you know, saving for a rainy day versus spending what you've got now, and how should we be thinking about that?
I mean, it's not your own money, so you should always be very thoughtful what you do, and I think it really depends on the vision where you want to take either the entire portfolio or just an individual molecule, and so that shouldn't be dependent on I mean, obviously, there need to be some adjustments made if you resource constrained. But in general, it takes a certain amount of data. I mean, the topic came up earlier that sometimes we're asked to do it very fast and then we regret this afterwards. I mean, we have to be clear that the investments at a phase one, phase 1B level will always pay off. I mean, given the costs of a phase two trial, even a phase three trial, it might be negative. So I don't really see the impact of money. I mean, you can probably take it a little bit more easy because you don't have to raise money when you have more equity on the side, but I don't see really that it impacts the way you would operate.
Yeah. I guess for my company, and both the opportunity and challenge is that we have three different business areas, right? We have complex generics, biosimilars, novel drugs. We have 8 or 9 people on our board, and if you asked on the board where we should be putting our money, Three of them would say we should kill everything except complex generics. Three would say put everything in the biosimilars. And, you know, so you're always having that dynamic as well. But I guess a specific example I could give is for the oncology program. We have a phase 2 pancreatic cancer study ongoing, and we made the decision to do it in a robust way and include a control and try and power it in such a way that we could get real data. And we made that decision at a time when we didn't have much money, but we felt it was the right thing to do. If and when, and maybe now we have more money to invest in that program, I'd want to pursue additional indications. But I'm not sure it would have altered one way or the other the decision around the individual study designs, you know, as part of that, you know, development plan for each asset, that I think you just have to try and do it the best you can. And as I said, don't take shortcuts and don't be inefficient on the other hand.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. I think, but you know, but there is a challenge. I think one of the things we talked about, and so you were in this situation, it sounded like you designed the study, you got it started, but maybe you did not, weren't sure if you would have the resources to either complete it or that you
We knew that. We knew we'd have the resources to complete the one study. Yeah.
Because that's the other challenge. I mean, you know, because you hear from the CEO and the board, oh, we'll get money, don't worry about it. Yes, you feel confident because you believe in the drug, and but I think that is a challenge to make sure that you don't cut corners and you actually get the result. Because if you don't, then you're not doing anyone any favors, not only the drug, but the investors. And,
time for a question before we wrap up. Go ahead.
You mentioned the fashion cycle, and you all kind of nodded at that. Was that the right phrase, fashion cycle?
I think there's targets that are on vogue at a certain period of time, and then sometimes they fall off grace. I mean, MET, for example, in oncology is an example. Yeah.
Well, the question is this. From your experience, could you give some insight into managing through the fashion insights on both spectrums, either the, you know, when it's over-exuberance, as you mentioned, or the other times when a study doesn't achieve endpoints, and then you have to stop everyone from jumping off the ship. What has helped you guys in managing through that fashion cycle and the skill sets that help you?
No, it's a great question. I mean, so much of it is negotiating with people who are financing the company and the board, and just to provide a perspective, I think, that, again, don't get too high or too low. And you can bring up examples of where things were all the rage, and you follow this out 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and all of a sudden it's not. So just to go into everything with open eyes. You know, take advantage of it if you can, right? If you happen to be in that immuno-oncology space and that's where all the money is, go get it, you know, and bring in as much money into the company as you can. But I think it's really just to provide that perspective, that objective perspective.
Yeah, and managing expectations well and being transparent. I think that's extremely important. That was also, I thought, an answer that fits to Lou's last question about whether there's a difference when you have a lot of money or less money. I mean, if you're transparent and always manage expectations, then you can be sure that people are still interested in investing biotech, pharma, at a time also when, in general, the funds are not as rich as they are right now. Yeah. So it's really giving credit to the industry. Yeah.
I would just say, you know, if you're lucky to be in that kind of hot area, just be careful not to overhype what you have and what you can deliver. I mean, you see this with the CAR T. Everyone's going, all right, I have a better one. And the odds are that they're probably not going to be all better, and they'll probably be pretty similar to each other. And I mean, I think it's really important to know what you have, what your experiments are going to show, not oversell it, and let the data speak for itself.
Any last questions before we wrap this up?
Great discussion. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.